3, 2, 1. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to The Process. Have you ever been critical of something you love, whether it be a person, your workspace, or the industry you work in as a whole? I know I have, and vocally about it too. So it got me thinking, how can we approach being critical about things we love in a productive manner? Which brings me to our guest for this week, Sarah Hoover, a director at the Gagosian Gallery. She has been working in the art world for several years and has been openly critical about some of the challenges that she has personally faced, but also as the industry as a whole. So I want to talk to her about what it's like to be critical of something you love and how we can all learn to approach this conversation openly.
Take me back to like before becoming a mother. And what your perspective was in the art world, which is, you know, predominantly a space that celebrates people with a lot of money and people who have the privilege to be able to create. How did you originally fall in love with it? And when was the moment that you started to become critical?
So I studied art history in school and I just loved it. Like, I loved art history books and classes. I loved going to museums. I went to school in New York City, so I could go visit galleries. And growing up, I mean, I'm from Indiana and I don't come from a culture of, like, you know, coming to New York City to go to museums or anything like that. But I would go to the local museum in Indianapolis, which is a really nice museum, with my grandfather on the weekends all the time. And the opportunities where I did travel, you know, like my first time I went to Paris, of course I went to the Louvre and all that. But it wasn't really the culture of Indianapolis to be like really philanthropic in the arts or anything like that.
Yeah.
But I really loved art history through studying it. And I did the internship program at the Metropolitan Museum when I was in college, which is like a very coveted internship. It's really rigorous. You work in all 19 curatorial departments. You're paid. It's like a proper thing. And I thought that I would end up working at the Met after I did that. I loved it. I went away to graduate school. And when I came back, I applied for a job there. And it's a bit of a bureaucratic process. So while I was waiting for that job, I was sleeping on a friend's couch, basically in Chelsea. And while I was waiting to hear if I had gotten the position at the Met, I was walking around galleries and I walked into Gagosian and I started speaking to someone at the front desk, and it turned out they worked there and their assistant had quit that day. And they were like, can you come back with a resume? So I like ran across the street, printed out my resume and came back, and they're like, great, can you start right now? Because she's leaving tomorrow and this is the only time she can train you. So I was kind of thrown in, and
wow.
It's like a story of incredible luck, right? But like, also,
how long ago was that?
This was 13 years ago.
Okay.
But also, like, luck, because I had, like, a rich friend who lived in Chelsea that I could crash on their couch across the street from the biggest gallery in the world. And, like, when I walked in, I, like, looked the part. So it's not, I mean, I would love to say that, like, they had never seen me and I had, you know, written a brilliant thesis without ever going to school from, like, a trailer park in Indianapolis. But, like, that's not what happened. It was just really right place, right time, the stars lined up, luck, as so many things are. So I started working at the gallery, and I was like, first of all, I was really psyched to have a job. I was still in graduate school, but not going to classes anymore. I was just writing, and I obviously needed a paycheck. And it was really fun and really wild, and I was really swept up in learning about the secondary market and the primary market and all these kind of ways that art is commodified that I hadn't learned about in the museum world, and I hadn't learned about in my own arts education in academia. And for a while, I was really mesmerized by all of that and how fast-paced it was and how glamorous it seemed. But I started to notice that the most glamorous things about the art world to me weren't like the billionaires coming in with their drivers and their jets and the blah, 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 and spending $150 million in a day and the parties and all that. The glamorous thing was the artist who, like, didn't give a fuck and came in, like, you know, not wearing shoes or whatever and living, like, the life that you would think the point of, like, getting really rich, you would think, is to, like, feel, I guess, secure in letting yourself be as weird as you want. But, like, none of the rich guys were being weird. It was all the artists who were, like, actually living free lives. And I was like, okay, now that's glamorous. Like, glamour is Salvador Dali, like, walking his pet lobster or whatever, you know? Glamour, to me, is, like, having an idea and being able to fulfill it out of your own creativity. And I think once I realized that, I became a little bit more critical of the ways in which art is commodified and the way in which it seems to really play into a system where a small group of mostly white men use art, which is the product of like the greatest things that humanity has to offer, which is the, you know, creativity of our minds, to make themselves get richer at the expense of other people. And sometimes not just at the expense of other people, sometimes, you know, there's something in it for other people as well. But I was kind of amazed that there are these people who are constantly buying and reselling and trading art and getting rich off of this like really pure creative act that is so like essentially human. And I was like, wait, this is kind of messed up, right? And once you see the cracks in anything, as you know, mm-hmm. you start to like really want to break things open and really see, you know? So like once you see it, there's no going back, right? And like, I'm fascinated by the art world and I think there are so many amazing things about it. And I feel obviously very fortunate to have my job and to work for someone who is a trailblazer. And like Larry's a genius. And every time I talk to him, every sentence he says, I learn something, and he's incredibly articulate and efficient. And it's like a very special place to be. But I think if you had my job and you like weren't aware of the messed up stuff, you'd be doing something very wrong in your life, because the art world is the apex of everything that is problematic about, you know, capitalism in general and the state of the world. And that it's on the one hand, there's no one who has done more for art and artists than Larry, because he is so incredibly generous and allows artists to really fulfill their dream projects. And he has spaces all over the world that are free and anyone who wants to go in them can. But I do also feel complicit in a system that I think is in some ways, you know, antithetical to what I really love about art.
Well, that's so interesting that you say that, because it reminds me of that James Baldwin quote about criticizing America because he loves her so much, right? And I think many of us work in industries that we tend to criticize. I work in an industry I criticize and I talk about every single day because I love it so much.
Totally.
So how would you advise people to approach criticism that way, but still being able to show up with the intent to make change?
Well, I mean, I think that you probably look at yourself and I look at myself as like an opportunity to show the possibility of like a more just way of existing in the world, in our specific sphere of the world. So I don't know, like I go to my office every day and I like try and be really kind and helpful to the women around me and to the young women, or like my assistant, who's a wonderful young man. He's so smart. I, you know, want to like give them a leg up, which there wasn't done for me by
I think about that all
colleagues,
the time.
You know, sometimes it's just as simple as like being the good person to people who are beneath you in the hierarchy of your job, and like explaining what you already know about the world and that it's okay to have contradictory feelings about things. Like everything's a contradiction, everyone's a contradiction. And that if you're just aware of what those contradictions are and you can navigate that world thoughtfully, it doesn't mean you can't participate in it. I think it just means it's kind of on your shoulders to like educate the people around you and treat everyone as well as you can. And you know, one of the other great things about my job is that Larry, in a way, like kind of lets us use his money. I mean, he uses so much of his money for good. He's incredibly philanthropic, and that story's not told enough. But, you know, for example, last night, like Ugozian took a table at Art Production Fund, which means the Art Production Fund has X amount of thousands of dollars from them that they get to use for public art projects next year that are for everyone. And so I do have like some incredible resources at my disposal, and I it's cool that I could like go to Larry and be like, hey, I think that this arts nonprofit is really remarkable. Like, will you give them 15 grand or whatever? And often he does it. So I think there are ways within the systems, if you're thoughtful, to do what you can to like make the world better by using the systems that maybe aren't 100% good.
Right. Well, so last night, we celebrated you and your husband, Tom Sachs, who's an artist,
right.
The power art couple, and all of your incredible work that you do in this space. And one of the things that Tom mentioned was his intent in making work and art accessible, and the importance of making all of this accessible to people because it often isn't. How do you see accessibility playing a role in this space, and what more needs to be done?
Oh, I think so much needs to be done because if you walk around the galleries in Chelsea, which are all free and they're open, you know, every day but Sunday, a lot of them are open on Monday, some of them aren't, but everyone who works in them is white. And so while anyone could technically go to them, I think it's like really scary to walk into these huge monolithic spaces where you may not see someone who looks like you. So like that has to change. And the way that that changes is that people who are in the positions of hiring others have to make a real concerted effort to go find people who don't look like them. Because I think it's not fair to say like, oh, well, black people don't apply here. They don't send in their resumes.
Well, you know what's interesting is I remember one of the jobs that I was at, we had conversations about this too, because I remember one, like the first day that I walked into work, I didn't see people of color in the office. And one of our executives had mentioned, because she was really working hard to hire more people of color, and she was like, if you look at our website, there are no people of color, so why would people feel comfortable enough
of course.
To apply here because they don't see themselves there? And I've heard, you know, like former bosses say, well, they just don't apply. And I'd be like, okay, but here are applications that we're getting in. And so you have this like really surface level, you know, initiative of making your workspace more diverse. And I'm like very critical of that because I also feel like there's a lot of surface level diversity. It's a lot of like, let's put people who look different than us in these spaces because it's like the right thing to do, instead of being like, no, let's bring in people of different backgrounds, different ways of thought, different understanding, because this is what enriches our workplace. And you're, I mean, we're talking about like you specifically with art, which is a field of expression and storytelling, and like is only possible through perspective, is only possible of like being able to, you know, have an emotional tie to something that you're seeing and have something that we're able to see ourselves in. And so to me, like, I think, I guess my, not confusion, but the thing that always comes up in my mind is just like, what would the world look like if the art that we were seeing too were the levels of art that is celebrated more than ever were from people of so many diverse backgrounds and thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, the canon of art history is like predominantly white and male, right?
Yeah.
And I think there's no way that you can be empathetic towards other people if you don't see people who looked differently than you and see their creative output and what their version of reality is and understand that there are different realities in the world. Like, how can you exist as an empathetic human on earth if you don't do any of that? So it's literally essential. It's a moral imperative to show art that's made by people who have all sorts of different backgrounds and to include people in this art space who have different backgrounds. It's like not a question of good PR or doing the right thing. It's just like ethically the only option.
Yeah. You know?
And I don't think it's fair to be like, well, black people don't apply here. You know, people of color don't really apply. Like, of course they don't apply. Look at this place. You know, why would they ever feel safe here? It's on us, I think, to go like kind of solicit people and invite them in. And I mean, it's probably like illegal to do that. I don't know if it's, I know that there are like a lot of rules
about.
But I think, you know, I think an HR director of a gallery or museum should reach out to the historically black colleges and go and speak there and like describe the industry. And, you know, I don't know. I think there are a lot of ways that the gallery space could be a lot more, and the museum space could be a lot more inclusive. And I think they're starting to realize the benefits of that and make efforts towards it. But art itself being accessible, I think is the important thing about that is that that doesn't mean dumbed down, right? Like good public art that everyone can see is critical and rigorous. It's not, you know, an oversimplified, like pretty mural. I think that that's boring. And I think that the people who are kind of uninitiated in the art world, who that is meant to appease, are not interested in that. I think everyone, no matter what your background is, and particularly people who haven't had a life maybe like I've had, benefit, they of all understand art that is, you know, critical of the world that we live in, because they're living on the flip side of, you know, they're living the hard parts of that world. And I think good public art, and what Tom meant when he said accessible art, is art that isn't dumbed down, but talks about, deals with issues of the human condition that are important to kind of like marginalized communities and people who actually experience hardship.
One of the ways I've heard you be described is the connector of powerful things to powerful people. And that is an incredible responsibility, but also, I mean, of course, an incredible privilege. How do you carry that?
Well, I have to say, I get a lot of joy out of connecting people to other people. And I feel like you do too.
Yeah.
It's something that brings me like an immense amount of happiness. It's to, I don't know why, but.
Well, because that's like something that's priceless.
Yeah. And it's the best when someone does it for you. So like,
so
why would
much.
You want to do it for other people? But it's different when it's connecting things in people, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there is part of my job that I feel like is almost like selling cars or something. Like someone comes to me, they want a specific thing that's maybe scarce in the market, and I find it for them, and it's really expensive. But I enjoy knowing that a lot of that money is pumped back into the part of the arts community that I'm the most interested in, which is the creative process. And, you know, Larry's constantly funding museum exhibitions for artists for museums that don't have big enough budgets to put them on themselves, or funding projects for artists that really change the way that everyone sees the world. And I mean, I have long thought artists look at the world in different ways, and because of that, in different ways than like normal people, right? And because of that special ability that they have, they can see solutions that someone with like a very normal kind of average way of thinking like myself could never come up with. And I see this in my house with Tom all the time when I'm like, you know, trying to hang a shelf and can't figure out how. And he's like, oh, like I don't have the right size screws or something. And he comes up with some weird ingenious like life hack. And it's something, it's small things like that. But I also think on like social justice issues or, you know, bigger worldwide problems, the way artists approach, you know, a problematic situation is really outside of the box. And like that power is so amazing. So yeah, there is part of my work that is really transactional. That's just connecting things in people. But I know that the economics of that also fuel something that is, could really, I mean, every civil rights movement in history has had the participation of and the language of it given to it by artists. And my, I mean, most famously, like, you know, May 68 and the riots in Paris and across Europe and the Czech Republic. Most of those ideas come out of avant-garde radical art of the 20 or 30 years before. And that's like a very special power that an artist has, that it can give a visual language or words or, you know, a treatise or whatever towards movements that actually change people's lives.
Do you have a personal way of valuing art?
I mean, to me personally, the art that I want to have or want to exist the most is just art that I love. Love looking at, want to live with, want it to be around me. And that for me is art, like I mostly like art that has deep narrative content. Like I like art that's about things, not necessarily that's just beautiful, though of course that has its own merit. I don't, for me, like as a personal collector, I don't pay attention so much to the market, to auction results and secondary market results and you know, how scarce, how rare something is to come by. I really just want things that I can live around and be interested in over and over, and interested in the topics that they bring up and that the art is about. But I think people derive value in really different ways. And I hear a lot of times from clients and collectors that they want to be assured that something will retain its economic value or grow in economic value. And that's like a bit of a dangerous game to play, because none of us are fortune tellers. We can't see the future, right? But there are, of course, metrics for understanding what something is most likely to be worth in time if things go correctly. And for me personally, I kind of ignore all of that.
for people who just don't get it, I mean, you've described how you personally value art and why it's so important historically and in understanding people in the rest of the world. But how do you deal with, like, the frustration of, like, I just don't understand, like, what this means or why this is, like, up here, or why this has a price tag or why people are staring at this for so long?
I think I actually don't hear that very often. Because I think anyone who's, like, getting up to walk around Chelsea and go into galleries or go to museums is most likely already, like, a very curious person, right? And, I mean, I'm sure that you agree that curiosity and constantly asking questions is, like, the greatest gift of life. Yeah. So, I mean, I think if... It's, in a sense, that that is also... ties into the topic of accessibility, because a lot of art seems really elitist because you have to understand these, like, very sophisticated concepts to understand it, especially if it's, you know, like, conceptual art. Often there's no actual thing that results in it. It could just be like a text on a wall explaining a project. And I can see why someone who is unfamiliar with, like, the entire context of art history and what's important about conceptual art and how conceptual art was invented would find that valueless. And I would hope that anyone who's going to look at art like that would be curious enough to, like, Google and, you know, educate themselves a little bit on why that kind of thing is important. But that is, like, an inherently elitist thing, right?
Right.
To have to do that. If the only way you can understand art is by, like, having all of this information that is, until very recently, only been taught in art history class and, like, private colleges, then that alienates a lot of people from whole swaths of art history, whole swaths of the contemporary art world, which is, you know, I don't know, that's complicated.
Yeah, I mean, I think it kind of also just goes back to how do we critique the spaces and the industries that we love so much?
Yeah.
And how do we approach really kind of evolving? I mean, you are a radical feminist and you talk about, like, dismantling the patriarchy all the time, and you're very, very vocal about this. And sometimes, like, I'll read a caption that you write on Instagram, or I'll hear you, I mean, last night in front of 1,000 people, like, talk about this, and I'm just like, whoa, like, a lot of you're addressing, like, a room filled with people who, like, are a part of that thing that you're talking about.
Right on it.
Yeah. And so it's just like, well, one, I just want to know why you became so passionate about this and what moment in your life were you just like, wait, what? And then how do you take that with you and harness that energy in the spaces where you're working and, you know, you have some of these transactional and just, like, relationships that you're building that are with people who are thriving on it?
I grew up in a very political house. My mom was a sex crimes prosecutor in the second sex crimes unit in America in the 80s in Indiana, a very conservative state.
I should have known that when I met her yesterday.
Very cool, right? And and my parents are both lawyers. My mom doesn't practice law now. She has a different career. But I grew up always, like, very aware of the fact that the world was dangerous for women. And I grew up very critical of systems that kind of perpetuated that danger because of my mom. But I certainly think everyone agrees, like, the last election really galvanized all of our feelings about patriarchy. And as I have honestly had more access to the internet, and it sounds silly, but even through Instagram, I've become so much more aware of, like, radical feminist thought. And I've read so many things that I was never introduced to before. And everything that I've read and learned has only confirmed my feelings that I've had since I was a little kid of what I've heard from my mom, that the world just, like, really isn't set up to be safe for women. It's set up to be really safe for white men. And not for anyone else. And then I have been personally frustrated by that in my own career in several ways that are, you know, insidious but not horribly damaging, because I'm lucky. I think it's much worse for people who fall in other parts of the food chain. I've seen friends who have been, you know, kind of marginalized because they're women. And all of that kind of like builds up and it's frustrating, right? And then, of course, when the Me Too movement happened, I felt like I suddenly had a language to describe things that I had kind of inherently understood for a very long time, but couldn't call rape, couldn't call, you know, it gave me new words and new understanding of things that we've all experienced. And then I had a baby. And there's kind of nothing I can imagine that attaches you to the feminine than doing like this most basic female act of giving birth. And through that process, I was so constantly shocked, horrified by the way that women are treated both while they're pregnant and while they become mothers and after they have kids as a mother. And that made me so angry because it's when you're your most vulnerable and you're literally allowing our species to continue and you're not protected by any system. And if it's bad for me as like a rich white, normally blonde lady.
Lavender.
Today I'm a little lavender, but normally blonde. Then it's horrible for everyone else. And that is unacceptable, especially in the richest country in the world. And I was so angered by my experience that it has made me like much more militant.
Can you describe some parts of your experience that stick out to you the most that you feel like you were blindsided by?
Yeah. I mean, like I took AP Bio. I'm not stupid. I like have the internet. I didn't know until about a week before I gave birth that you bleed for, it can be 8 weeks after you have a baby, like heavy bleeding, but you can't use tampons because a baby just came out of your vagina. So you have to wear like adult diapers. I didn't know that, okay? How is it possible that I didn't know that? But I think many women don't know that. And if women don't know that, then that means men don't know that. And unfortunately, men are most of the time the decision makers who, you know, decide policy and legislation. And if they don't know that for 8 weeks after you have a baby, you have to wear an adult diaper, then when they're making decisions about like paid maternity leave, they're not properly informed. And in a sense, I can't blame them because I wasn't even properly informed. I went back to work 21 days after I had my baby, by choice, not because I had to, but because I had been working on a project that I had spent 3 years of my life putting together and I wanted to see it through. And in order to do that, I had to be back at work 21 days after I had Guy. I had to fly across the country and wearing an adult diaper and like leaking out of every hole and like puffy and fat and miserable and away from my baby who was too little to fly. And when I got to LA where I was working on this project, my male colleagues wanted to have a meeting at the pool at the hotel they were staying at. So I had to go to the pool in an adult diaper so that they could all swim and like keep a towel around me because I obviously, there was no way to like explain this incredibly awkward, horrible human moment, but it wasn't even a thought that would have ever crossed their minds. And that felt so unjust to me. Like if a man had just had open heart surgery, I think everyone around him would like take that into consideration, but nothing about, everyone was really impressed that I was there, but that was it. Beyond that, there was no, I didn't feel like cared for. Not that my colleagues owe it to me to like, you know, take care of me medically. But I just found that the whole male world was so thoughtless about what I had just been through. But of course there were 1 million examples of that. I mean, while I was in labor, I got like mansplained by the anesthesiologist who was giving me an epidural who like, as he was sticking a needle in my spine goes, oh my God, do you have scoliosis? With like disgust in his voice. And I wanted to like rip his head off. And I mean, it was never ending. The way that men like victimized me when I was pregnant, walking down the street, catcalling me. I've never been more like, I don't know, kind of dehumanized than when I was pregnant, which was shocking to me. At first I was like, oh, they can't see my bump yet. My boobs are big. Like, of course they're whistling at me or whatever. But then once I was huge, it got even worse. Men would come up to me in line at the grocery store and go, when do you do? Strange men, which just implied that they were looking at my body, which implied that they thought they were allowed to look at my body and comment on it. And I found that enraging. Like, it was this really sacred, special time in my life. And for some reason, the world has told so many men that that belongs to them. And I was like, God, I can't even have this. So all of it together, after the election, after a lifetime of like already being kind of critical of all of this, I really had enough. And having a baby and realizing that I'm like so fortunate in my life and it was still terrible made me realize, not certainly not for the first time, but it made me realize firsthand how awful it is probably for a lot of other women who aren't so lucky. And I think that conversation really has to change. Like the narrative around motherhood and around baby making and around how women in our culture are treated absolutely has to change.
What are some of the tangible takeaways from that experience and just leading up to this moment now that you've implemented, whether in the gallery or in your life, that you're just like, these are the things that I have kind of dedicated myself to. These are the things that I want to personally change about, you know, my perspective on the world and the actions that I'm taking as an employer, but also as a mother.
I mean, I think incredible, like, honesty and authenticity is essential because the reason that I felt so in the dark about my pregnancy journey was just because, you know, I think women are really trained to like be polite and smile and just handle shit. And often even to one another, we aren't completely truthful about the dark realities of our lives because it's not part of our cultural training. Our cultural training is to like be pretty and perform. And like we can all perform good girl, good, polite, nice girl really well, right? But very few of us feel secure enough to be able to be like very honest about what is actually going on in our world and the traumas that have happened to us and what life is like as a woman. I think there's like nothing braver than a woman who's unafraid to just simply tell her story. Well, there are a lot of brave things in the world. I shouldn't say that, but I think it's a very brave move to not be afraid to tell your story as a woman, even if it's kind of simple, you know? So I try and be as honest as I can about things, even if they're like gross or medical or whatever. I feel no shame about the fact that I bled for, you know, weeks after I had a baby, that I had terrible, crippling postpartum depression, that I take antidepressants for it, which literally saved my life because I was suicidal. I think just like the more honest you can be, I think, you know, manipulated silence is the way the patriarchy keeps us down. And like just to be honest in the face of that is a bold move that I think if we all make an effort to do even a little bit can help push the narrative towards a space that is more positive for people who are a little bit marginalized or a lot marginalized.
How do you do that and reckon with any level of imposter syndrome you may be suffering from throughout?
I feel imposter syndrome all day, every day. I feel it right now while we're sitting here. And I like, the only thing I can say is you just have to be brave and push through. It's like not allowing yourself to cower in the face of your cultural training. But easier said than done, right?
Yeah.
And easier for me than for a lot of people who like don't have any sort of platform or safety net.
Well, I also think that imposter syndrome generally, and this is something that I've gone through in my industry, but it makes you like less confident in criticizing the space because you constantly have this idea of, oh, well, like I should feel lucky that I'm even here. You're just expected to be happy with the standard that's been set for everyone. And I'm now realizing that being so honest with your experience and with your story is the most freeing thing that you can do because every single time you do that, people you may have, like, you may not have known even existed around you raise their hand and they're like, oh, wait, I'm going through that too.
Totally.
Or, oh, wait, like, I thought I was the only one in that space. And you start to garner more voice. And then you realize the system is set up and the way that this industry is set up is that you're not supposed to complain or you're not supposed to talk about certain things. But the reason you're not supposed to talk about certain things is because everybody's going through the same thing and you shouldn't be able to kind of do anything about it.
Yeah. I mean, if women were really, really loud about how much life has been made difficult for them, if we were all super honest about it, we'd all be rioting in the streets.
Yeah.
And that's why the system doesn't want us to be really honest about it, right?
Yeah, but I mean, I do think that, so two things that I
talk about a lot. Imposter syndrome being one of them, and I think just like putting it out there that everybody has insecurities, like every single person is struggling with that, and we all deserve to be in the place that we're in. But the other thing is also horizontal hostility. And if you're familiar with the term, or for viewers and listeners who are not as familiar, I talk about this a lot, but it's just the concept of feeling hostile or strangeness towards people who have similar values and goals as you, right? And I think that this exists a lot within the feminist movement, where you find that there is traditional like white feminism, and then there's intersectional feminism, and there are so many tensions. I mean, even just there are so many layers under that, whether it's just like with the Women's March not including sex workers or trans exclusive or whatever it is, like there are so many factors under it. And so we end up within our own communities where we share similar values, but we're still, you know, struggling to move forward because we're so used to like picking at each other. And it's really hard to kind of carry that energy into a space where you're already doubting whether or not you're supposed to be in that space, but also want to like be a voice of change and reason towards people who have the ability to make changes and make decisions, because we're often like, we're not always at the decision-making table. So how, and this is kind of also a side rant, but just as someone who is in the position that you're in, how do you suggest people balance the hostility that they may feel towards people who are similar to them or not so similar to them, and struggling with maintaining their sense of identity when they get to a position that they can make those decisions?
It's very hard. I mean, I understand what you're saying about hostility. I think that you have to keep in mind that change is slow. And when you are in a position where you might be able to affect change, like nothing is overnight. And you're never going to, it's very rare that you're going to meet someone that you agree with on everything, right?
Yeah.
So I think knowing that, but knowing that there's like always possibility for commonality. I mean, I feel really lucky because like I grew up in Indiana and I had friends who were going on spring break to the Creationism Museum in Kentucky and who didn't believe in evolution. And I grew up with like very different education and understanding than that. But I'm really glad that I knew people who were really different than me and was able to talk to them about things that were meaningful. And I feel that now, like even someone who's like on our team, but maybe who doesn't have the exact same brand of feminism that I do or whatever, it's still worth to be able to dialogue with them and still worth it to be able to be in conversation with them. And if you're approaching those conversations like you just want to win and you know you're right, well, guess what? That other person thinks that they're right the same way you think you're right. The person who is going, my high school friend who is going to the Creationism Museum for spring break and who believed that dinosaurs lived at the same time as Adam and Eve, it was just as sure of that information that I am of, you know, evolution, that I am of Darwinism. So you can't get anywhere if you're both really sure of the information you've been told. You're not going to get anywhere by arguing with someone, but you can get somewhere by having open, generous, kind dialogue.
Do you have a strategy for that?
Yes, you have to be educated on what you're talking about. You have to, you know your shit. You have to, of course, in today's day and age, be able to cite sources and all of that. And you have to be like very empathetic. Any conversation is an opportunity to win someone over to your side. It's every conversation is an opportunity to, you know, build with someone. And yeah, if you approach it like that, and I mean, the worst case scenario, if you are willing to listen to someone who has different views than you, is that you will understand more about the way that they think.
Yeah.
And in order, if you're trying to combat the way that they think, you have to like know your enemy. So worst case, it's a fact finding mission, right?
And you're gaining perspective. And I think that should always be an intention, is yeah, we should consistently gain perspective because people do think differently than us. When we do voice our opinions and our concerns, whether it be in the workplace, whether it be criticizing the industry we work in, or whether it be with a loved one, when we are rejected in our way of thought, or when we are put down, what advice do you have to keep, you know, a strong heart and to continue steadfast in like what you know is true to you?
Well, I think in anything, especially if you're participating in a way of thinking that's kind of radical, there are always setbacks and there are always people who don't believe in you and who don't want you to succeed. And it takes an incredible amount of strength to continue in the face of that. But to me, like, rejection is almost the same thing as success. It almost means the same thing. Like, half the time, shit doesn't work out, and half the time it does. But what matters is that you are following your intuition and trusting in your integrity. And if you get the results that you want or not, it almost doesn't matter, because what matters is that you're doing something that you know is right and you're following your own personal journey. And that alone, it's not enough, but that alone should bring you like enough joy and fulfillment that you are willing to continue doing it. And like, if it doesn't, maybe you're not doing the thing that's right for you, you know? I mean, I think I talk to people all day long, and I say some little comment about misogyny or something, and I can tell immediately it's like doesn't resonate with them. But I feel so strongly in the way that I see the world and in the potential I see for change that I'm not going to stop doing that. And I feel really passionate about those topics. So I'm not going to, you know, even though I think that change will be very slow for us, I'm not going to stop following that passion.
Yeah. On this path, in this moment of your journey and in your life, how is your heart doing?
I feel great. I feel very grateful and very fortunate all day, every day for so many reasons. And I feel very personally fulfilled because I work in the art world, which I am able to speak about critically, and I have a lot of freedom at my job where I can participate in things like this and also go into the office and talk about the, you know, monetary value of art. I can like dabble in both sides.
Yeah.
And I also, I just wrote a book that is kind of a side project, but that's something I'm very passionate about. It's about motherhood, and that has brought me like a lot of joy, and I just truly feel lucky that I'm in a place where I can be involved in all of those things. And as you know, my nonprofit work is incredibly important to me, and I can imagine like nothing luckier in the world than being in a position where I can give money away is, I mean, unreal.
I always say it's like it's such a privilege to be in a position to give, and I always pray that we like remain in positions where we're able to be like someone who can give.
It's so joyful. There's like nothing that makes me happier. The main reason I want to get rich is so I can keep giving money away, because I have not found joy from anything the way I have from finding causes that I believe in and knowing that I can support them in meaningful ways is like one of the luckiest gifts of my life.
Well, I'm very lucky to be having this conversation with you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It means so much to me.